Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This month marks the 100th anniversary of publication of Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. Our guest this week, David Levering Lewis, a biographer of Du Bois, tells us about the man and his famous book. And after that, Anita Wills will give us some historical perspective on racial profiling. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on April 27, 1865, just days after the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, another disaster struck. The event attracted few headlines because of the assassination, but it was one of the worst disasters in American maritime history. The riverboat Sultana, with its cargo of an estimated 2,100 returning Union veterans, sank on the Mississippi River. Only about 400 survived, the loss of life topping that of the better-known sinking of the Titanic in 1912. During the Civil War, the Sultana served as a Union vessel carrying supplies and troops on the Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio rivers. After the war ended, it was commissioned to transport battle-weary soldiers home. While steaming up the Mississippi, its boilers exploded, and the Sultana was engulfed in flames and sank.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we'd like to provide two updates on matters we have covered recently on Talking History. First, the Vatican has begun releasing documents from its archives dealing with the Roman Catholic Church's relations with Germany on the eve of World War II. The documents, some historians report, offer proof that the Vatican did intervene on behalf of the Jews under Hitler's rule. The Vatican is opening its archives on this subject in response to criticism that it was silent in the face of the Holocaust. The documents are from the period from 1922 to 1939 when the future Pope Pius XII was a Vatican diplomat in Germany and the Church's Secretary of State. In updating a recent show on the notorious feud, more than a century after the last shots were fired, the Hatfields and McCoys have gone to court to resolve a dispute over a cemetery. The dispute involves whether a road leading to the cemetery where six McCoys are buried is public, as the McCoys contend, or private, as the Hatfields insist. The feud between the Hatfields and McCoys of Kentucky began in the 1870s over a stolen pig. It escalated over timber rights, and by 1888, at least 12 people were killed. The violence ended by 1900 and shows no signs of reviving, despite the court case. This is Talking History. W.E.B. Du Bois was an African-American. But he was born free, earned his Ph.D. from Harvard, and became a leading, if controversial, civil rights leader. 100 years ago, he published Souls of Black Folk, and Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, marks the anniversary for Talking History by discussing Du Bois and his famous book with his guest, David Levering Lewis.
W.E.B. Du Bois was one of America's foremost intellectuals and civil rights leaders. The first African-American to receive a Ph.D. from Harvard, he was a prolific historian, sociologist, and social critic. Souls of Black Folk, his most important book, appeared 100 years ago this month. According to my guest, David Levering Lewis, its publication in 1903 was one of those events dividing history into a before and an after. The book, he says, redefined the terms of a 300-year interaction between black and white people. David Levering Lewis is a professor of history at Rutgers University, a MacArthur Fellow, and the author of a 2-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, both volumes of which received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Lewis, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Du Bois was born free in Massachusetts in 1868, the year coincidentally in which the 14th Amendment granted citizenship to black Americans. How did he come to know racism?
Du Bois speaks to that point quite poignantly in the Souls of Black Folk when he describes a moment in the high school, or it may have been elementary, the versions alter as the years pass, when, as an exercise in good manners, the students were exchanging visiting cards, and a newcomer to Great Barrington, his little township in western Massachusetts, burned his card. And he writes that at that moment the veil descended, and he knew from that moment that he, though much alike with the others in heart and mind because of skin color, was different. It's particularly poignant because it's the first use of the term or the metaphor, the veil, which was to be rather a signature term in Du Bois's writing to indicate the divide that came upon America after the Civil War based on pigment.
The Souls of Black Folk consists of 14 essays, some of them previously published. What was the genesis of the book as a book?
Well, I think by 1901 or 2, as you say, only 5 of the collection's essays are original to the collection. I think he felt that the state of race relations, North and South, had reached such a point of oppressive disequilibrium that something had to be said. And what particularly drove him was the famous bargain that had been struck between the leadership in the South of African Americans, represented by Booker Washington, and the White South. And he thought that it was just absolutely necessary to state unequivocally that the surrender of civil rights in exchange, supposedly, for economic progress, slowly but surely, was a very bad bargain. And so I think the essay of Booker T. Washington and others, that essay is really the main point of the collection, although, of course, it's so rich and varied that it is simply one of the many extraordinary reflections upon the time and the status of race relations.
Du Bois says in that essay on Washington that Booker T. Washington is the most distinguished Southerner since Jefferson Davis. Now, there might be some present-day U.S. senators who take that as praise, but Du Bois didn't mean it that way, obviously.
No, well, no, he didn't. What he meant to suggest was that if Jefferson Davis was a disaster for the Republic and certainly for the kind of society that would have prevailed had the South won the war, in many ways, Booker Washington represented the victory of the South in defeat, in the area at least of race relations, in that he was the agent of the manipulative planters and businessmen who were calling the shots after the dismantlement of Reconstruction in the late 1870s.
Du Bois writes at several points in the book that a black person in America has a double consciousness. What did he mean by that phrase?
Well, I think he meant that one could be in the social contract and in American society, and yet strangely and painfully not of it, in that because of the, I suppose one would say, the nationalization of the one-drop rule of group identity, one drop of Negro blood disabled you, it meant that 10% of the population was in fact marginalized. And so irrespective of success, irrespective of the commitment to all the virtues and values of the society, there was this box in which people found themselves and were unable to get out of it.
It's as if almost he's rejecting a couple of other alternatives, that there would be those who would want blacks to be segregated, to be separate from whites. Others want them to be somehow assimilated, and Du Bois seems to reject both of those. He says at one point he doesn't want to Africanize America, nor does he want to bleach his Negro soul.
Yes, I think that's particularly significant, that paragraph, because my reading of it is that it was a clear and rather smart adumbration of multiculturalism at the top of the 20th century. It has to be remembered that there were a number of thinkers of that period who were increasingly unhappy with the melting pot paradigm. Horace Kallen, most particularly, who spoke for Jewish Americans, but there were others like the Hapgood brothers who spoke for ethnic Americans, who thought that there was in the American experience room for retention of cultural and even linguistic traditions, and that the rather forcing house design in which people were to be mainstreamed on a model that pretty well approximated the Anglo model, the WASP model, was not entirely desirable. And that's what Du Bois was really saying, that there should be room for the enriching experience and complementarity of blackness and whiteness, with both respecting each other's cultures and space, as it were.
One evidence of that, it seems to me, comes before every chapter in the book. Every chapter is prefaced by a few measures of music, unidentified music, and by words of poetry. The music turns out to be music of blacks, the poetry often of canonical white poets. What was Du Bois' purpose in including them in the way he did?
It was to those epigraphs, as you say, that at the top of each chapter were intended to signal that the message of the songs sung in bondage by people of color, that is, the spirituals, must be appreciated, and the words written in freedom by white people would remain hollow and counterfeit until the message of the sorrow songs was appreciated. And so there was a complementarity of understanding that was necessary in order for democracy and human rights really to make their way.
Was he also, in a sense, challenging the traditional cultural hierarchy, which placed white stuff at the top?
Indeed so. It was subversive in that sense. The message of the semi-literate people coming out of bondage was as profound, as significant, as liberatory as the, as you put it, the canonical verse of Swinburne or Tennyson or Ruskin, say.
Du Bois advocates racial equality, but that doesn't seem to have stopped him from being on occasions an elitist himself.
Well, yes, I don't suppose there's any necessary conflict between the two. Elitism is completely, I would have thought, compatible with racial equality. That is to say, I think that it's simply a realistic admission or concession that in every society, in every place and time, some people are more endowed than others, either through opportunity or through native gift. So Du Bois, in the early part of the 20th century, simply accepted the fact that a much disabled group, because of the experience of slavery, could find its way best by being represented by its best. But by best, he did not mean elitism or snobbery in a parochial or a selfish way. He meant that there was an obligation on the part of those who were advantaged to lead the group. And that is often lost sight of when Du Bois is reproached for a supposed elitism. It's really just a perfectly legitimate idea that with ability comes an obligation of leadership.
The most quoted line from Souls of Black Folk, even Du Bois repeats it, is the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Was Du Bois simply saying that race was a problem in 1903 at the dawn of a new century, or was he going beyond that and making a prophecy about how slowly racial equality would come about?
Oh, I think decidedly the latter. It is prophetic in that it's not only a statement which is, in a sense, a verbal snapshot of the conditions that obtained in 1903, but it is his forecast that American society, and indeed much of the global society and community, is going to be bedeviled by the business of race. He meant that, too, I think, in a somewhat broader way than simply pigment. I think it becomes clear soon after the publication of The Souls of Black Folk that he's also speaking of the economic consequences of racism, and that the two things really do go together, that the exploitation of people based on pigment is, of course, driven by and complemented by economic disabilities, which he will give more and more emphasis to as the years go by.
Do you have a favorite passage or a favorite part of the book?
There is. It's hard to select from what is such a luminous text, but so arbitrarily I would take the passage in The Souls that reads that it is, he says, to be a poor man in a land of dollars is hard. To be a poor race is the very bottom of hardship. And that quotation, I think, speaks to what I was just saying about the economic implications of the problem of race in the 20th century, as Du Bois conceived it.
What still is the significance of Souls of Black Folk?
Well, in every group experience, there's a moment when there is an articulation of aspirations and of conditions that is simply unique, memorable, poignant, and this is such a document. It's a photo of conditions at the moment. But it's also a crystal ball of what is to come, both a warning of how American society will find itself travailed if it is not faithful to its highest political and social ideals, and his insistence that one must fight to make sure that those ideals are always to the forefront.
Well, Professor Lewis, thank you so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been talking with David Levering Lewis, the author of W.E.B. Du Bois' Biography of a Race, and the second volume of the biography, W.E.B. Du Bois, The Fight for Equality and the American Century.
Thank you.
Racial profiling has come under intense fire lately, but as our guest commentator this week suggests, racial profiling is not new in American history. Anita Wills is the author of the forthcoming book, Notes and Documents of Free Persons of Color, Colonial Virginia, 1650 to 1850.
Racial profiling is an act that has roots in colonial America. It began as a means of subjugating natives and Africans for their land and labor. Profiling of natives began during first contact when Europeans described them as having big lips, though nothing so unsightly as the Moors, broad noses, and brown skin. Later, Africans were profiled by hair texture and skin color, and as a race suited only to labor for Europeans. They were to be slaves for life in the system set up in America. Any deviation from the established profile was seen as an affront to whites, who often challenged people of color without impunity. Although racial profiling is no longer an act backed by written laws, it is alive and well. Keeping the laws off of the books affords a protection to law enforcement agencies that deny their existence. There is no paper trail, and those who are complicit in the act are not admitting any wrongdoing. The laws are understood, passed down in department briefings, and carried out by the rank and file. Mary, born 1730, and her daughter Patty, born 1750, came under Virginia's racial profiling laws. George Washington's father took Mary to the Westmoreland County Courthouse, where she was adjudged to be 7 years old and mulatto. The senior Washington received a 30-year indenture for Mary. Colonial laws were based on the economics of black and brown labor. Racial profiling is, for want of a better word, a gateway act, an act that will eventually expand to impact every citizen regardless of race. In our democracy, laws specifically targeting one group of citizens over another are void and indefensible. Yet justice is stacked against the average citizen who cannot afford a protracted legal battle. In 1780, seven African-American residents of Dartmouth, Massachusetts, presented a petition to the legislature. They were protesting paying taxes and not being allowed to vote. Several of those petitioning were soldiers in the Revolutionary War against the British. No sooner had one conflict ended than another started. Today, those who pay the most per capita taxes are the least represented. America is moving backwards and creating a climate of mistrust and fear. Many Americans are now facing taxation without representation, especially in the area of constitutional protection. As a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people, we must have a government answerable to the people. Until there is a referendum and movements to forever abolish all forms of racial profiling, we will remain a country stuck in the past.
You've been listening to Anita Wills, author of the forthcoming book, Notes and Documents of Free Persons of Color, Colonial Virginia, 1650 to 1850. Wills' commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. This is Talking History.
Get ready, let's meet here tonight. Come along, let's meet here tonight. I know you find your family walk, there's a meeting here tonight.
Come along, let's meet here tonight.
Finally, for our site of the week, Fiona Beatty is here to tell you about a museum dedicated to an unlikely leading figure in the American Civil Rights Movement.
The Rosa Parks Library Museum, part of Troy State University, honors the woman who sparked the Montgomery bus boycott. Parks, the bespectacled, petite, 42-year-old seamstress, had no intention of making history when she boarded the Cleveland Avenue bus after work on December 1st, 1955. She was tired after a long day and had a lot on her mind. Absent-mindedly, she sat in the front seat, but when told by the driver to move to the back, she refused. Her refusal led to the bus boycott, which is often cited as the beginning of the civil rights movement in the South. The museum tells the story of Rosa Parks and the bus boycott by ushering visitors through a series of rooms wherein the story unfolds. In the first room, for example, visitors stand to watch a three-screen introductory video. Then a door opens, and people walk to the Courthouse Square bus stop, recreated in the next room. Diesel smells belch from the bus on display. Its brakes screech, and the conversations aboard are recreated. For more information on the Rosa Parks Library and Museum, go to www.tsum.edu.museum. And if you go to Montgomery, be sure to visit the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church, where the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. preached, and also the Civil Rights Memorial.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. And you can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian Laveau.
Our God is a rock in a weary land, weary land, weary land. My God is a rock in a weary land, a shelter in the time of storm.
My God is a rock in a weary land, weary land, oh weary land. My God is a rock in a weary land. He's a shelter in the time of storm.
Oh, well, go away, you long-tongued lion. We don't want you in the despair.
Oh,
well, we don't want none but a few born souls that have been washed in the blood of the Lamb.
My God is